You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guests on the podcast are my close friends, Major Jason Drew and Stuart Lyle. If you've ever listened to my show, you go back, listen to everyone I've ever done with Jason and Stuart, or as I call him, Stu. You'll know that these are the other two world's leading experts in the study of urban warfare. An honor to have them back. Today's topic will be strong points. I think it's an understudied, underpracticed, underappreciated aspect of urban warfare, especially high intensity urban warfare. We're going to talk about what they are, how they're used, offensive, defensive, advantages, disadvantages. It's just a really interesting, very subset, but even Jason and I, who wrote an article, man, it seems like years ago. If you go back on the Modern War Institute website and see, I think it's Tactics of Defending a City, snipers, obstacles, but strong point is there. Even if you go to the mini manual for the Urban Defender, there are many pages about building strong points in the city to defend, even if it's a hasty defense. But we're going to get into all that. Guys, thanks for joining the show. If you could just give your quick introduction in case any listener hasn't heard you on the show before.
Thanks, John. Jason Giroux. I'm an infantry officer with the Royal Canadian Regiment of the Canadian Armed Forces. And for the past 23 years, I've been an urban operations instructor and an urban warfare historian.
Hi, John. Thanks for having us back on. It's an honor to be on here and talking about this. For those who don't know, I'm Stu Lyle. I'm the Urban Ops Research Lead for the UK Ministry of Defence's Defence Science and Technology Laboratory. I've been studying urban operations not as long as Jason, but I've probably been focusing on urban operations for the last 7 or 8 years.
Nice. So again, if you haven't listened to our show, this could be a whole podcast show just titled An American, a Canadian, and a British Urban Warfare Expert Walk Into a Bar, because this is really what I want the show to be, us just discussing something that is reoccurring in especially very contested, high-intensity urban combat, which we have seen a lot of in the last 2 or 3 years. We'll give examples throughout history, not just recent history, but the fact that they're there. I'll kick it off because I think one of the things that is neglected is just, what is it? What are you talking about, strong point? As I was a part of a very big training center, and they asked, what would you change, smart guy, for us to prepare for urban combat? I'm like, well, number one, where are your strong points? How are you replicating the presence of strong point, whether you're practicing defense or offense, major, large-scale combat operations? And it sparked some ideas. I'll give my definition, which I'll use doctrine, but that I would love to hear, because this isn't just about the American military doctrine, but like, how do you define an urban strong point? So according to our doctrine, a strong point is a heavily fortified battle position tied to a natural or reinforcing obstacle to create an anchor for the defense or to deny the enemy decisive or key terrain. Very open. That is not terrain specific. As you know, if you've ever listened to the show, I hate where I grabbed this definition. It went on to say that the technique's purpose is to deny terrain and redirect enemy formations. So it says commanders can use a strong point defense when anticipating the enemy's actions will isolate a defending force, retaining terrain critical to the defense. Commanders also prepare a strong point for all around defenses. Now, that was out of an urban manual. I won't say which one, but it wasn't urban specific. And this is why I wanted to have you guys on about urban strong points in the three-dimensional terrain. What are they? How are they constructed? How are they defeated? All of that. But Jason, over to you. Do you agree with that definition? Do you have an urban specific, a simpler one?
Well, you know, John, actually, I'm quite happy that you actually went to the doctrinal publications, because I'm a big, haven't done this for so long. I've read Canadian, American, British, Russian, NATO, French, Swedish urban operations and Australian urban operations doctrine. And so I always find doctrine's a good start state. It's always a good start point. So the fact that you went into a doctrinal publication gives me a nice warm and fuzzy in the tummy. But my definition actually pretty much matches yours, although if we want to put an urban context to it, I also think it's building or subterranean structures that are built strongly either through natural means or human-made means, and they're able to withstand a lot of punishment from munitions, if I can get a little colloquial there. And I want to emphasize that strong points can be natural strong points because due to the construction materials of the buildings and some historical examples of that, you know, the Battle of Ortona, some of the buildings during the Battle of Aachen and Battle of Manila, some of the buildings in the Battle of Hue and Second Fallujah and Marawi, where because of the natural construction, it was, you know, thick reinforced concrete or old stone brick or something of the such. And then there's human-made strong points where, you know, the buildings are reinforced with sandbags and lumber and steel girders, et cetera. And, you know, some good historical examples like Pavlov's house in Stalingrad, or the Battle of Manila, where the Japanese were reinforcing the buildings with sandbags, or the Battle of Ramadi, where the Americans were building, you know, these combat outposts into the city. So buildings are subterranean structures that are strongly built, either natural and or human-made, and they can withstand a lot of punishment from munitions, is what if we want to add the urban context to what a strong point is.
Okay. Yeah, no, I got it. This is both the advantage and we joke between ourselves of having a best friend that's a historian, is that he's going to discuss history. Stuart, is there any difference to that definition that through your years of studying them as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to disagree with a definition that's as vague as that. so yes, I would fundamentally agree with that definition, but as you say, I don't think it is a particularly useful one. And this is sort of a recurring theme in sort of doctrine of sort of most nation sorts. I think when you speak to people, certainly people in uniform who are taught, and you talk about urban strong points, what their mind immediately runs towards is the classic, you know, sort of urban defense house. The one building in the urban training area which has been done by the engineers to withstand, you know, sort of area fires and sort of the zombie apocalypse even. So it's that house that's ringed with barbed wire. It's got the grenade sumps under the window. It's got sandbag emplacements in the windows and internally, and all the shored up ceilings and all that sort of stuff, which is great. But that doesn't necessarily sort of encapsulate the whole thing. And when you actually go back to some of the old World War II doctrine, when we were developing the first real sort of urban doctrine that we had, they were very much thinking along the lines of the street or the neighborhood or that avenue of approach into the urban area as being the strong point, not just the individual buildings. So I think what we'd like to do is try and get people to think more broadly about a strong point and saying it's not just a building, but it's actually a portion of this urban environment that you're going to try and use as that sort of hard nut. So you're going to prep the entire area, so the street, the side streets, the individual buildings, creating sort of those overlapping fields of fire, that sort of thing. So that, to me, is an urban strong point, not just a building that, you know, sort of looks like it's been sort of plucked from something like Mad Max.
Okay, I like it. I mean, I will agree. So I didn't give my definition because I would define it almost by its attributes. So that's what, in a definition, words have meaning. I would want a definition that actually finds its attributes, like what makes in the urban terrain a strong point, which would help people identify, which is really the question when I go out to have is like, okay, look, you've been assigned to defend this. How are you defending it? Well, I'm going to do a battle position, which is you're basically assigning an area to be defended. Like, okay, but you know, most people will discuss, but strong point defense is a thing. Conduct a strong point defense because of, and why do I want to have a show on the Urban Warfare Project podcast about urban strong points is because I believe, I doubt my colleagues will disagree, that within the urban terrain, which we can debate if you want, within the urban terrain are the presence of ready-made strong points in some variables. But I agree with Stuart that a strong point isn't just a really strong building that can take a lot of damage. It's definitely one of the key attributes is that by construction, or like Jason was saying, you could add to, but by construction, there are inherent buildings within urban terrain ready-made to be turned into strong points. But location also matters, like Stuart's saying, depending on what your defense schema maneuver, or your area development, engagement area development, all that, is that there will be buildings that should be the anchors to the defense. And then it gets to a time like, okay, if I have this ideal, which is people do, right? City agnostic plans and things like that. Like when within the urban terrain, we'll talk about some of these examples, whether it's Pavlo's house in Stalingrad, Rizal Hall in Manila, the Treasury building in Wei, the bank in Suez City. There are things that are inherently strong, but that doesn't necessarily mean that should be your strong point, because location, I agree with Stu on like avenues of approach, you know, depending on if you're building your engagement area development, but also fields of fire. What makes a good strong point is, you know, if it's a concrete reinforced, steel reinforced building, you know, what we classify as heavy clad, with very good fields of fire, with a subterranean aspect to, even if you bomb it, which we'll talk about, like, how do you deal with a strong point? Some of these historical examples and why Jason and I listed it as an overwhelming reoccurring factor in high intensity urban combat is the presence and the challenge of strong points, depending on if you're attacking or defending. But that location and the attributes of it, not just a strong building, but as we'll talk about, a strong building, good fields of fire, protected, you have maybe you put in some mouse holes between ceilings and get you to, you know, to the different levels, lets you escape and evade. We'll talk about where entire buildings have been strong points, have been turned into multi-week battles, even inside the building, just by the nature of how it was built. Sometimes we build strong buildings and they come back later to be a challenge. Okay, I think we've given enough people things to chew on, like what is a strong point. Hopefully we'll integrate a couple examples to include my interpretation of history, which is always interesting. Okay, strong points can be an advantage. Absolutely. They can be a disadvantage. Absolutely. But I want to, in order to give our show some structure, which my dear friend Jason is very good at. I'm not, like, I just want to have a free-flowing conversation, but we'll meet in the middle. We defined it. Somewhat. I gave a couple of the attributes, but I love giving people examples, and I hope we do that. Jason, what are a couple? So let's break into the defense, right? So Stuart and I should do another show on whether the defense is the strongest form of warfare. urban defenders win? You know, these higher level questions. But as a defender, I think we all three can agree that a strong point defense within urban terrain can be an advantage because of the fact that it's a ready-made fortification that you could, if you know what you're doing, use to great success in the defense. And there are a couple historical examples. Some are more myth than reality, but hey, I'm a storyteller as well. Jason, what are a couple? Let's go back and forth. Me, you, and Jason. Or me, you, and Stu, on our favorite stories of how strong points are used in the defense, which is what most people, for us U.S. military people, we're always attacking. And we'll get to, like, how do you build a strong point? But I want to hear a couple of stories to wed, like, why are we having this conversation, where strong points have become a major challenge in urban battles.
Okay, so, well, I think the first advantage is that when you have a strong point, it can certainly stop your adversary's momentum as they're moving forward through the urban terrain. And so what happens, you know, as the enemy is moving down the street or through the buildings, suddenly they come upon a strong point. And because it's so naturally and or human made strong, they now need to spend a lot of time and a lot of resources and a lot of munitions in order to defeat it. And John, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to take Pavlov's house. as the example. Well,
you tell your version of history and I'll tell mine.
So during the Battle of Stalingrad, from August 1942 to February 1943, Pavlov's house was this four-floor building that was just west of the Volga River, and it gave these dominating points of view for about 5 kilometers in all directions. And it jutted out into the German lines. So when the 13th Guards Division happened to have that area of responsibility, the 7th Company of the 3rd Guards Rifle Battalion, they had Sergeant Yakov Pavlov and four of his soldiers did a night raid to take the building in late September 1942. And then the platoon commander, Lieutenant Afanasyev, I hope I pronounced that correct, he was able to provide reinforcements and machine gun crews and mortar crews, anti-tank rifle crews. They were able to build a minefield and barbed wire at the north end of the building. And there was about 150 soldiers in this four-floor building. And they dug supply tunnels back to the battalion headquarters, back by the Volga River. And for 4 months, German infantry and armor assaulted this house daily, almost sometimes several times a day, trying to dislodge the very stubborn defenders. They would rush the lower windows. They would try to push the barricades aside, but they were met with this withering machine gun fire. Sometimes it came down to hand-to-hand combat. German Stuka fighter bombers would come in from above trying to, you know, destroy the building. At one point, Afanasyev calls in pinpoint artillery fire from across the Volga River to drive off an attack. Pavlov himself is to have destroyed, about a dozen tanks with an anti-tank rifle. So it was called Pavlov's house because he had taken it, and because he had taken it, they named it after him. And even though the urban legend, it was, 58 days, it was actually 4 months of fighting. And it was a pain. It was a thorn in the German side because, trying to attack or get around this house was, and it just killed their momentum. And so as a result, it was a very successful defense of an urban strong point within this particular city battle.
Okay. I'll give my interpretation of what you just said. I'll just say it a different way, but Stu, do you have one that is one of yours that you give as an example?
Yeah. So I take a slightly broader view of it. Like I said, it's about defending sort of the neighborhoods and a particular area within that urban environment, not just a single building. So I think the one that stands out for me is basically Daesh's defense of Mosul. And one of the reasons why I think that's important is because they were able to sort of they were able to mix the use of strong-pointed buildings, as in sort of the classic what people think when we talk about strong points, but also mix it in with that mobile defense and actually have that sort of almost sort of hammer and anvil approach to defending their areas of the city. So there's no one single building, but it was more about that approach that they took towards that defense. And I think it's also an important case study to look at about urban defense because it's an urban defense that took place in the age of precision guided munitions. And I think that's an important distinction that we really need to draw out, because when you look back at some of the historical examples, it's when either air and artillery wasn't available, or when it was available, it wasn't precision guided effects. Or when we start talking about advancements in weapons technology, this is the era pre thermobaric munitions, or whenever the biggest infantry shoulder launched system was a 2-inch bazooka. Things have moved on since then and gotten more effective at anti-structure type effects. So I think it's important to look at a case study in the modern era where you've got the integration of precision effects, and that really does kind of force people into this kind of strong point for limited delay, followed by sort of covered mobility for counterattacks. So I think, no individual building that we can point to, but it's more sort of that general approach that Daesh took defending Mosul.
Okay. I agree with you, especially we could do a whole show on the precision paradox that my friend Amos Fox kind of coined the term, but I use it liberally, that even if you build a strong urban defense, precision guided munitions gives you the ability to strike that strong point very precisely. But if you built the defense correctly, that won't completely negate the ability to move from strong point to strong point and execute a strong point defense, which is what we saw in Mosul, where they just destroyed building after building, because of the nature of the construction of the buildings and the preparations that have been done. I actually wanted to read more doctrine, and Stu kind of keyed me to that, is that, yeah, don't let me, I love the talk because I think it does. I like storytelling, helping people visualize, strong point. But even the urban doctrine says that cities themselves can be strong points on a more operational level, which I'm sure Jason can give us, like the history of the Ortona, Aachen, where these cities become key strong points, the anchors to a much larger defensive line, right, Jason? That people will call a strong point. And there, I'm trying to visualize, as even for the lower tactical level, but yes, you can absolutely expand this to the operational, especially the operational. I don't know about strategic, but the fact. So I'll pick one out. Well, let me go back and give my quick 30-second Pablo's house, that this single apartment building complex. And actually, if you go to Volgograd, there's a plaque for it. There are these stories, you know, the hot gates of Thermopylae, of even the Azovstal steel plant, of these defenses that become major problems for the attacker through this anchor, right, system. And Pablo's house is one of those quintessential stories of a single building being held for a very long time with a lot of preparation beforehand, right? You had anti-personnel mines around the building, wire, they would reseed the anti-personnel mines, a massive force attacking this one building just in a key location in the city. When they bomb it, the defenders, debatable how many, let's say 20, Jason will say many more, but they went to the lower levels to include the basement when it was being bombed. If a tank attack came, they went to the higher levels with machine guns, rifled grenades that they would fire down on top of the personnel and the tanks approaching, but they were successfully held this. So that's one of the reasons why it's continued both in myth and reality as this quintessential defensive capability. But there's plenty of examples. Me, Jason, and Liam Collins just published the Battle of Morawi case study, which I highly recommend, which talks about the Philippine army really struggling with dealing with some of the stronger defended buildings by construction, location, and tactics being used by the enemy, to include the Pink House, which I recommend. It's another one for me, a quintessential. If I had to pick one, I would pick Rizal Hall in the Battle of Manila, part of the university and hospital complex, where a very large Japanese force held these buildings, and the U.S. forces paid a heavy price to take individual buildings, to include having the Japanese had put sandbag bunkers inside the building, not to protect the outside, but to have the battle inside. And it really caused a major problem. Jason, I wanted to ask this question it's more of a tactical, of course, question of what are you looking for if you're identifying within your scheme of maneuver to build a strong point? What are the key things, like if you were just doing a terrain walk, which I know you do a lot with the training of forces that you do, of saying, okay, look around you. What in this environment would make a good strong point defense? And we've talked about many of them, but I think how do you build a strong point is, for me, it escapes U.S. military doctrine, but I think it escapes a lot of people.
Well, one of the things I really stress when I'm teaching urban operations, and one of my lessons learned, and ironically, I'm rewriting the Canadian Urban Operations Doctrine of Publication right now, and literally rewriting the chapter on intelligence preparation of the battlefield in the urban environment. The start state is to do a very thorough intelligence preparation of the urban environment using your military intelligence analyst, but then leaning on your common engineers. And I don't know if you have the same in the American military or British military, but we have geomatics technicians within the common engineer branch. And these are soldiers who are specifically trained in geography and geomatics. And that's your start state, because once you start, then now you can do your visual reconnaissance of a city by looking at all the satellite photos and the maps and the locations of buildings and getting into the research portion which is really what the intelligence preparation of the urban environment does. So if you start that with that, and you can start identifying locations that are going to be important for you in the urban battle, and then from there you can start say, okay, where are the natural fortified strong points that are either near or at those locations, or what do the engineers have to do to make these buildings? What do they have to bring in to reinforce these particular buildings so that they become strong points? I think that is the start state. And then once you've identified these areas, then you have to do the physical reconnaissance of the urban terrain and say, you know, either and verify whether these buildings and subterranean structures, because they can become strong points too, whether these are good to go or not, whether they give good points of observation and fire, whether they, you know, how much reinforcement do you have to bring in, or are they good enough already because of the natural construction materials? And then once you've done that physical reconnaissance, then it's having the time and the labor and the resources brought in order to, you know, reinforce or to build positions. As you mentioned, John, you know, the Japanese building the sandbag bunkers inside of Rizal Hall and other many buildings and during the Battle of Manila. So doing that to finally get the strong point good to go and ready for battle.
Okay. Stuart, I want to ask you the same question. And if it is at that higher level, like we have seen, to be frank, when you talk about more defensive, but there is even within a city, there are portions of a city that are stronger than others. They have been, they have reinforcing natural obstacles like waterways. Why have every major battle over Kyiv focused on certain areas? Why is the Battle of Bakhmut a portion of the, on the one side of the river where there are stronger buildings, that's a much different fight? Or going back to Mosul, Western Mosul is a much larger fight than Eastern Mosul. Are there anything, things that you would be communicating to military forces, like when you're looking for strong points, look at this?
Yeah, I think the main thing that I would try and stress to people is thinking about what does it look like from the outside. So camouflage, concealment, deception, those really come to the fore in this day and age when we've got precision guided munitions, we've got thermobarracks that can be deployed by the attacking force. Going back to Pavlov's house, it was a five-story building with a 1,000-yard view in all the surrounding area. If you were attacking it today, you would just identify that. That it doesn't take a genius to do intelligence preparation in the battle space and recognize that's going to be a threat. And then dropping a whole series of precision guided bombs on it.
If you have them.
If you have them, yeah. We're looking at, the British Army's doing an awful lot of discussion at the moment, thinking about operating in a NATO context. So, the threat in that piece would be Russia. And if you look at what they're doing at the moment, President Zelensky reported that they are using approximately 3,500 of these precision glide bomb kits, the UMPK kits, every month in Ukraine. So that's where you're taking a very cheap dumb bomb and you're attaching a precision guided kit to it and then being able to lob it from 40k plus away and give you a reasonable area, a reasonable circular area of probability that's going to hit a building. So that's why I'm saying we need to think about strong points in this day and age and sort of update it to what the threat picture is today. If making sure that what the buildings that you do plan to defend don't look like buildings that you're planning to defend, because they're going to be the first things that are then sort of hit in terms of sort of prepping the environment, shaping the environment in order to then allow the assault ground force to actually then move in. So I think camouflage, concealment, deception really is the one thing that I try and stress to people is, the old school defense house that we've got on the urban training sites, it looks like a building you're going to defend. Now, can you replicate that across an entire neighborhood? Because I take your point, you can't necessarily strike every single building. maybe you can, but maybe it's unlikely that you're going to try and strike every single building. So if you can replicate that, but that's a huge resource effort that's gone into making every building look like it's this defensible area. So I think there's an awful lot of thinking needs to go into how do we do cam and concealment for these defensive preps while keeping it there, because all that stuff about shoring up the ceilings to protect against the ceiling collapsing and all that sort of thing, that was designed in an era where you were protecting the building against area fires, unguided area fires, or against light mortars that would actually strike the roof. And I think in the modern era where the threat has been escalated, we do need to think more about making sure that the defensive prep stays reasonably sort of covert until the point where you as a defender decide to then initiate that contact.
Yeah, can't complain with that. I would, if we had more time, a problem I run into with, which I want to transition to now that we're getting into it, like what do you do about strong points that you encounter, is the ideal that you'll have those large diameter precision guided munitions to deal with strong points in a high intensity urban battle that has been prepared for defense, which I know you guys understand all the nuances of what I just said, amount of time the defender has to prepare, the construction of the buildings, the presence of subterranean environments, and the collateral damage to basically reduce a strong point. Even with large diameter precision guided munitions, there's always context to that. So for me, the only thing I would add is I think would be that the overhead protection, some buildings size, the actual building construction, which is a very small page in our doctrine, like what's it made of? Is it made up the cement blocks, reinforced steel concrete, steel girders inside of it, you know, too high heights, but the subterranean, I honestly believe, and why I put that in there, if you're going to have a strong point, it better have, if you have the time, which goes back to Jason's on, if you're going to improve even a naturally or already present strong point, one of the big attributes for me because of the presence of such lethal munitions is a subterranean aspect to this, even like Pavlo's house had, even like the buildings in Bakhmut had, which caused more problems. This is the presence of basements in where the Russians are spending, you know, thousands of artillery rounds or even aerial guided munitions on buildings, which the subterranean allows you to stay protected somewhat or move out of that building once you have decided that it's no longer, you want to have a you know, the ability to have primary, secondary, alternating positions. If they're strong points, that's great. But I think I would add just the one thing is a subterranean environment, if possible, on top of that construction, the concealment, everything. We got to transition though. We got to talk the historical ways, militaries. Stu started to get into a little bit. The historical ways in which attacking forces, and of course, we're always attacking, nobody's defending, but hopefully somebody got something out of the defensive portion of this on it's, there's a lot of defensive advantages. Stu, can I say advantages in the urban terrain to be the defender of urban terrain? You get there first. If you have 2 years like ISIS did, you're going to have a lot of advantages and cause there to be a lot of challenges for an attacker. Or if you had 15 years, like we've seen Hamas, you can create a whole environment that's going to be a huge challenge for any military of the world. But there are historical examples of what militaries have been able to do to reduce strong points they encounter. And I have a couple on my mind, but I want to pass it over to Jason. Now we're going to transition into attacking strong points. If you want to call it reducing strong points, dealing with strong points, but what are some of the historical ways up to modern in dealing with strong points?
Thanks, John. I think there's three, and I'll talk about two and probably leave the third one to you because I have a pretty good idea as to what you think the third and fourth ones are going to be. So if it's a small strong point, I'll endear us to our good friend, Dr. Charles Knight, who posts many a video on social media showing satchel charges or large explosive devices being used and being tossed into a building in order to deal with the defenders inside. So that works for small strong points, but for larger strong points, I see a historical pattern throughout urban warfare history I've seen this. It was at the Battle of Aachen in October 1944, the Battle of Seoul in September of 1950, and right up to the Battle of Maroe in 2017, where the pattern being close air support drops precision guided munitions onto the building, onto the strong point. That doesn't necessarily mean that that munition is going to kill everybody within that strong point. It might only, you know, destroy any positions that are on the roof or maybe the top floor of the building. But close air support first, followed by artillery used in the indirect and the direct fire roles, if it's in the indirect fire role with precision guided munitions, followed by tanks, infantry, and engineers approaching that objective, approaching that strong point, and using direct fire to get nice and close to it. And then once they're actually up and nice close to the building, with the tanks and the artillery still firing into the building with direct fire, having the infantry engineers run up to that strong point and breach it so that they make a hole in it somehow, and then followed by the infantry and the engineers getting inside that objective and strong point and starting, you know, the room clearing, still with the armor and the artillery on the outside, you know, taking care of defensive positions that are further in depth within the building. So it's a historical pattern that I've seen in many urban warfare battles: close air support, then artillery, armor, infantry engineers approaching the strong point, infantry and engineers breaching the strong point, and then infantry engineers clearing the strong point. And as long as you follow that successful pattern, which again, I've seen throughout history quite frequently, then you'll be good to go.
So you don't want to talk about tear gas and flamethrowers?
No, because I know that those are your two favorite topics. I've already stolen Pavlov's house from you. If I were to steal CS gas and flamethrowers, John, you would force me to hang up on the podcast, and I wouldn't be with you guys for the rest of this podcast. So I'll give that to you, John.
Well, I'll do it real quick. It's because it's historical, but also modern. I would have been fine if you would have added it in there. Two other tools used historically to great effect to deal with urban strong points. Context always matters. One has been tear gas. If you look at the Battle of Wei, heavy use of tear gas to successfully evacuate buildings that are being used as strong points. It doesn't mean that the close combat doesn't happen, but it takes some of that advantage away. Even in 2017, the Battle of Maroe, tear gas. I actually did a panel with the three-star general in charge of the operation at West Point. He talks about how effective it was. They had a building full of 50 diehard, willing to die for the building, ISIS, they tear gassed it, and they no longer had that defensive advantage. There's context, flamethrowers. It was general from the battle, the 2016 and 17 Battle of Mosul, said, if I could have got my hands on flamethrowers, I would have. Because of the fact that once they moved into the urban, which we didn't really talk about, the rubblized terrain, which can turn buildings and locations into really tough challenges to include strong points. If, like the Chechens did in the second battle of Grozny, where they're using slabs of concrete with car jacks and just elevating them up, fighting from this, and then basically de-elevating the slab on top of themselves. It's more of a defensive tactic than it is, but yes, tear gas and flamethrowers, whether that's available to said military, it's a very large conversation of policy and myth and lore.
I'm sure some of our listeners have bristled when you mentioned CS gas and flamethrowers, because obviously now many Western nations have banned the use of chemical, biological, radioactive, and nuclear CBRN weapons to include the use of tear gas in war fighting, which is ironic given that some of our national police forces are allowed to use tear gas on our own civilians. But back in the Battle of Hue, the Americans were still allowed to use tear gas, and the armed forces of the Philippines at the Battle of Maroe don't adhere to those regulations. But, you know, John, I know you and I agree that the use of tear gas in particular is quite effective, because once you launch it into a building, unless the adversary has prepared for it, they begin to choke. They're physically incapacitated to fight for that building, and they either have to either die in place or they have to withdraw to another building. And if friendly forces are, you know, wearing the proper CBRN equipment, like gas masks, and they can attack these buildings, And in the end, you know, CS tear gas will actually limit the collateral damage and limit the number of not only friendly force, but civilian casualties within an urban area. So if there's a strong point that's being particularly troublesome or stubborn, and you launch CS gas into it, you know, the defenders either die in place or they withdraw. And so this is one of the reasons why John and I in particular argue why we need to assume some risk and make sure it's used properly. But CS gas is an effective way to reduce a strong point. And if you ban the use of it, all you're doing is forcing militaries to use munitions and therefore creating, you know, not only adversary, but possible friendly force and civilian casualties as well. So even though some of our listeners have probably bristled at the fact that, you know, John is saying CS gas and flamethrowers are effective, there are some positive use, positives used to these particular weapon systems because of the enemy not wanting, not either, you know, not prepared to fight with CS gas or afraid of flame-throwing weapons like that, and they don't want to die in such a horrible death. So I just want to throw that out there for our listeners who may disagree with John and myself when it comes to the use of CS tear gas and flamethrowers.
Fine. You're going to make me one. We'll do an episode, Jason, on, and Stu, of course, on the use of tear gas, the legal aspects, because it's not technically banned. It's prohibited as a form of warfare in accordance with the Riot Control Agent Act. Our president can actually place the Senate ratified it. The president put an exclusion. He can actually authorize its use. It the policy aspects are very complex. The history of it, very complex. Well, the urban legends of urban warfare include these myths that tear gas is unlawful. It's a very complex discussion. Flamethrowers are not unlawful. White phosphorus is not unlawful. All individual, very large conversations. 100% agree with you. But this, you're going to make me say my new motto, which I know you guys know. My new motto is, you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. Not you, but like the facts of the use of tear gas or CS, as you call it, in urban warfare. What are the legal, actual standing prohibitions and things like that? And like you said, the Philippines weren't a signatory to the Riot Control Agent Act. It was an internal fight because there is interstate war, you know, policing actions. There's so many aspects. I want to turn it over to Stu, which I think will have a different view of even modernly. What would you make recommendations for when attackers encounter urban strong points?
Yep, thanks. So the obvious starting point is obviously your intelligence preparation of the battle space and identifying where the enemy is more likely to put those strong points. They're going to try and figure out, you know, where's the best buildings for them to strong point. And you can do the same ground appreciation and come to the same conclusions. Now the enemy's trying to figure out what you're trying to do, and they might not necessarily get it right. So if you have the opportunity, you could just isolate and bypass, in which case it's, you know, you've neutralized that strong point anyway. You don't have to engage it. So some of the big ones that have come up in history are ones that you could potentially have just bypassed and avoided, and just sort of isolated it. I think the next bit then is when you're actually trying to then fight your way to and through a defended urban area, then is it goes back to the classic, it's combined arms. I mean, you look at the integration of infantry to sort of screen forward and spot targets, and then you've got your armor, whether that be a tank or an IFE, to then move forward. And, you know, most modern IFEs are 25 millimeter or above for their main cannon, plus having, you know, 50 caliber remote weapon stations or 7.62 coax machine guns as well. That's a potent weapon mix to be able to punch through prepared defensive positions. So, you know, in doctrine, we talk about it takes one layer of sandbag behind a brick wall to stop a single 5.56 round. It takes at least two to stop multiple 5.56 rounds. So, you know, you extrapolate that and say, well, okay, how much is it going to take to protect myself against a 30 millimeter? Then suddenly, you know, your entire building is just nothing but a sandbag. And you got to think about, oh, what's, what's coming next. So I get your point that you mentioned earlier on, you know, an urban environment provides you that really.
I got to say, what kind of wall is a 5.56 passing through?
So the 5.56 round will it does have penetration. It does depend on obviously the angle that it strikes and the distance that it's fired from. But if anyone's interested, you can go on YouTube and you can see some of the penetration tests that have been done. And
not lately though, right?
No, not lately.
This is a thing between me and Stu, is that I love those videos, and somebody back then thought it was important to do. I think we need to update. And yes, John Spencer is available if the British, Canadian, or U.S. military want to, Redstone, Arsenal, I don't care where, want to set up a penetration test of common building materials, because even the construction of buildings have changed since that those videos were made, right?
Yeah, so there's one the British Army did back in the 1980s, and you can see it. It's on YouTube. But they fired the 5.56 round from the current, what is still the current service rifle, at multiple different barriers. So pine boards, sandbags, aerated concrete bricks, standard breeze block concrete bricks. And a few other ones. So, and you can see the difference there. And so there's this, and it goes to, there's an inherent assumption that a lot of soldiers make, that they say, oh, we need 7.62 to penetrate walls. That's not necessarily true, because depending on the barrier, individual rounds, yes, the 7.62 may well penetrate slightly further than 5.56, but 5.56 fired in bursts, or multiple 5.56 rifles firing at the same target, we'll defeat a wall in very quick order. So if you had a double layer brick wall, which is sort of your standard European construction, you'll get through that within 3 to 4 rounds. But that's because we don't do these penetration demonstrations very often. A lot of soldiers don't actually understand what their weapon systems are actually capable of doing. So that's why they recommend, even behind the wall, you'll put some sandbags. But like I say, if that's what it takes just to stop the standard issue assault rifle caliber rifle round, then what's it going to take whenever you're trying to integrate then IFEs and that combined arms piece? And that's before you even start looking at thermobaric munitions, which, you know, there's a plethora of shoulder launch stuff now, which is not, it's not just thinking about the big old sort of the TOS-1, the 220mm.
The Shamel, right?
Yeah, you got things like the RPOA. You know, there's a thermobaric round for the AT-4. As well, you know, so this is something that, you know, the US
Carl G, right?
So it's the same munition, almost identical. Yeah, but these things are proliferating. There's a thermobaric round for the ubiquitous RPG launcher.
So just because I do have some civilian listeners, Stu, you want to explain what a thermobaric is and is not?
Yes. So a thermobaric munition is one that is designed specifically to defeat bunkers or buildings, really to deliver its lethal effect inside an enclosed space. That's where it really sort of comes, that's where it has its greatest effect. The way it does that is that whenever it hits the target, the first stage is that it disperses a cloud of either an explosive material, a liquid, or a gas, depends on the weapon system, but it'll disperse this cloud, which will sort of very quickly fill the space, and it'll sort of move around furniture and obstacles and other things in the room as it sort of disperses. And then a fraction of a second later, that then gets ignited, and you have this blast that cascades through that cloud. What that does, which is what makes it different from a normal high explosive round, is that you get this cascading blast wave that lasts longer than a normal explosion. And what that does is it puts pressure on the walls, the internal walls of a structure. So it basically blows the walls out or
they also call it a vacuum bomb, if I'm remembering the mass media as well. Yes. Where it sucks the oxygen out and replaces it with fire, essentially.
Yeah, so that's the second part of the. So once the blast wave has gone off inside the enclosed space, because it uses so much oxygen, or even pushes the oxygen out of the room, first of all, to disperse the cloud. What that does then, once the explosion has happened, it then leaves a vacuum inside that enclosed space, which actually can cause more damage, because you've not only pushed the walls out, but you've now then created a vacuum, which is then pulling the walls back in again, or the ceiling. So it can cause that sort of secondary level of destruction. So they are, that's why they're particularly effective against bunkers and buildings. And like I say, they are ubiquitous. And they are no longer the preserve of state militaries. So this was something that the Russians sort of pioneered with the RPOA and have continued to do. But you will see TBG-7Vs, which are the RPG munition. You'll see them in the hands of non-state actors. They're currently being used in Gaza. And we've seen them throughout the Middle East and Africa as well. So, you know, these systems are things that have proliferated. They are out there. You can get the long-range systems. There's thermobaric munitions for Russian ATGMs. So, you know, you can have things like the AT-14, which has a range of over 5 kilometers, and it can deliver a thermobaric warhead as well. So now you're getting these precision-guided effects at fairly long ranges to deliver that sort of effect. So identifying where those buildings are and then being able to strike them with those systems, and that's even before you then, and then as you're starting to get into the close fight. That's, you know, they are particularly effective, which is why I think we need to kind of study more about how do we actually, you know, do the defensive bit, because we don't really know.
Okay. Number one, isolate and bypass. I know he doesn't mean that in the thing that keeps the militaries from studying is that this belief of them able to isolate and bypass urban areas. I actually love the idea of, if you know where the strong point is, you don't ever fight the way the enemy wants you to fight. And if you could infiltrate, depending on what your goal is, if it's terrain-based, enemy-based, friendly-based, if you don't have to attack a strong point, then don't. If you have which I think is an underappreciated aspect of the subterranean environment, if I know the enemy has a defensive line that's been prepared for many years like this, and but there's this subterranean environment where I could not engage that. Like, well, why wouldn't I do that? That's there. On the concrete penetration, I want to see the test of the small arms munitions against a ironclad steel rebore reinforced concrete wall versus even an Afghanistan mud wall where small arms were complicated to penetrate. From my perspective, I don't have anything more to add to my colleagues, but I will say, after being at hundreds of training events, is that militaries treat strong points as just obstacles, right? So they deploy what we call in the US military is SOSA, right? The suppress, obscure, secure, reduce, assault. Our Marine Corps brothers used to have a different acronym, but they've treated it, they're like, okay, you can run in a strong point, you do this. Look, I'm telling you, that's not all that needs to be done. The whole purpose of this podcast was, one, to know how to use them, and know how to deal with them if you run into them. I will say, like Jason said, if you remove a tool like tear gas, flamethrowers, for all the different policy reasons, but if you were to remove, which is a very effective way to deal with a strong point if you've found it, which is an aerial guided precision, large diameter munition that can penetrate concrete to include into the subterranean environments of a strong point. If you remove that, then militaries that are faced with this challenge will then, of course, have other challenges. We'll have to use other tools, and it's limiting. So I believe, the only thing I would add, because you guys didn't mention it, one way to deal with a strong point in urban defense, given, you know, of course, in accordance with all laws of armed conflict and precautions to protect civilians, is to drop it, to drop the building. I mean, if you know it's a strong point and you've taken all the precautions and every step, then you can put a precision guided large diameter munition into it and drop it. So the idea that you need to assault every strong point is also not true. And I think we've demonstrated that. Gentlemen, this is why I wanted to do strong point, because you can take a single strong point, either single building, or if we're talking about entire urban areas, strong point defense with many strong points, you could take that and extrapolate so many aspects of either preparing a urban defense or attacking an urban defense that has been prepared for defense or is a hasty defense. So, like I said, I mentioned the Battle of Suez City, where Jason and I have written about this as well, where the Egyptian defenders had prepared the banks to be key to their defensive because of how strong they are from aerial attacks and direct assaults. There are many historical examples, but it's reoccurring. And we're saying that militaries need to prepare for them, but also there's an advantage. There's a huge advantage if they play a role. Militaries need to be prepared for both the advantages and disadvantages of them, both in the assault and the defense. And we could keep going on concrete penetration, on how to fully integrate a strong point into either an area defense, a mobile defense, a perimeter defense, or you just want to call it a strong point defense in the urban terrain. So many ways that this thing that keeps in our minds, keeps reoccurring in major urban battles against contested urban terrain is the strong point. I want to leave, though, give each one of my colleagues a chance to give their parting shots on the topic of strong points, and then we'll wrap it up. Jason, go ahead.
Well, I'll echo what Stu said earlier about the bad example of, you know, on a training exercise where the engineers and the infantry pioneers come in and they just build the one building. And everybody knows that that's the strong point. But you can't, in reality, you have to have a number of strong points that are somehow mutually supportive. I'm not necessarily suggesting that, you know, you have to have like, you know, six buildings in a row have to be strong points in order to be mutually supportive, because the urban terrain varies in height and density and depth. You can have strong points that are separated from each other, but are still mutually supportive with regards to points of observation and points of fire. So just to build the one strong point may not be good enough. Once you've done your intelligence preparation of the urban environment, and once you've done your reconnaissance and you've identified the certain buildings, you got to make sure you're going to be building a number of strong points, probably within a mobile defense, which is what I've seen most often in urban warfare history. And they got to be mutually supportive. If not, then they're isolated and they're bypassed, and then the opposing force will just come back with large munitions later on. They'll let it wither on the vine, because at one point you're going to run out of resources, whether it's rations or water or ammunition, or they're just going to come back with a large ammunition and drop the whole building, as John mentioned earlier. And a good example of this is the Battle of Groningen from the 13th to the 16th of April, 1945. I got to talk about my Canadians. So 2nd Canadian Infantry Division fighting the Germans in the Battle of Groningen. The Germans built strong points, but they weren't mutually supportive. So they're already at a disadvantage because they're fighting Canadians, but now they're even more at a disadvantage because the Germans built these strong points that weren't mutually supportive. So the Canadians were able to destroy them one at a time as they were working their way through the city. So my parting shot is to make sure that your strong points are mutually supportive, so that they just can't be isolated, bypassed, and then taken care of later on.
Thanks, Jason. Stu?
Well, Jason stole my point, which was going to be about how do you integrate those strong points into mobile defense. So thanks, Jason. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to fall back on the classic, you know, so I'm a researcher, I get paid to research new things. And actually, so I think one of the things that we need to do, and not just the British Army, but other people in NATO, is actually understand what does urban defense look like. If you have to, you've drawn the short straw and you have to defend an urban area against a peer opponent. How do you do that in the era of precision guided munitions, IFVs with large caliber cannons, and thermobarics? I don't think we really understand enough about how we can mitigate some of those weapon systems, and how do we do the modern equivalent of that World War II or even Cold War style building with all the barbed wire around it. So I think what we need to do is do some more research and actually find out what does this mean. There's some vague statements in NATO doctrine about they do sort of note thermobarics and basically it says things like try and mitigate the blast effect, but there's no guidance as to how you would necessarily do that. So I think that's something that we need to do. We collectively, as you know, sort of an alliance and partners, we need to sort of figure out what does urban defense look like in the modern era.
That's a good one, Stu. I'll give you that credit. That was a good one. What I'll say, one, thank you both, as always. We could actually create another podcast series just called Strong Points, because I think it would give you so much historical representation of them in battles, to all these different attributes of how do you use them, how do you reduce them, advantages, disadvantages. We don't have enough time. I'll say, with my last parting shot, is you may not have interest in strong points, but they have interest in you. You're going to see them. You better know how to deal with them. And adapting to the presence of strong points hasn't gone well in history. We didn't even talk about even the Second Battle of Fallujah. With all that intelligence preparation of the battlefield, and you still had strong points like the house where Sergeant Bellavia was awarded a Medal of Honor for his actions in this over this one house hastily prepared as a defense, a strong point, and it caused a lot of problems. I say build them, practice building what it takes to and incorporating them even in a planning exercise. Build them so that you know how to construct them, even in planning, identify them, how to select them. And if you build them, have somebody then attack them. So you learn through, like, it's context matters. How you deal with a strong point will come down to context, the everything from building material to the restrictions on the use of force during that operation. But don't let it be a surprise, because it's going to be there. It's there today across many theaters of combat in urban terrain. It's going to be there in the future.
Hey, John, I got to say, I've been, I've been passionately studying this subject for 23 years. And I have to say that the neat thing about studying urban operations is that because it's so complex and so challenging, you can always learn something new every day, every week, every month. And I have to say, and it goes for this podcast. I love coming on this podcast and talking to the two of you, my fellow urbanistas, because I learned so much today. And I think it's because of our backgrounds. I mean, John, you mentioned you're an American. Stu's Irish, I'm Canadian, but it's also our backgrounds, right? John, you're a passionate researcher. And I don't know if you know this, folks, but John's been all over the world. He's visited Mumbai, he's visited Susha, he's been to Ukraine 4 times since the Russo-Ukrainian war started. He's been to Israel now 3 times since October 2023. And he interviews participants in urban battles. He interviews brigade commanders, division commanders, and you can tell the passion that he brings to this particular subject. Stu is a defense scientist. So he's all about the tactics, techniques, procedures, the equipment, the weapons. Stu is trying to get our soldiers, sailors, aviators, and Marines psychologically and physically prepared to fight in urban warfare. And I'm an urban warfare historian. So, you know, the three of us are urban operations instructors, but the three of us attack the problem of urban operations with these three very different backgrounds. John, a researcher, Stu, a defense scientist, and me, an urban warfare historian. And I have to say, Stu and John, thank you for inviting me to the here, to the podcast, because I learned so much today just from the two of you talking about strong points, and I hope we can continue it in the future.
Oh, group hug. Jason, we are 3 legs in a single stool. I don't know of anybody, and this is why I always bug you to come back onto my show. I don't know anybody else in the world, literally, who has spent as much time studying only urban warfare, combat in urban areas, the full spectrum of urban operations than you, Jason, and Stu, not necessarily by position, but by passion. And when our three minds come combined, I learn something every day, and that's why I'm a student of all of this. I learned more and more each time, and to include Jason's pre-work before the podcast, even though I told him not to. I think that's the beauty of our friendship and in the study of this, right? Hopefully, and there are others from all different of our backgrounds, all the different communities, to a civilian, to a high a policy maker or a decision maker, that learn something from this and our other episodes, and how much can be learned from, you know, digging deeper and deeper into these topics of such a undercovered field. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks very much, John.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.